From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Once you cross that fence, once you decide to fight back, everything is different. You cannot contact anyone on the other side. That means no phone calls, no letters. You may never see your family again.
Catch a Fire, a new film, tells the story of Black South African freedom fighter Patrick Chamuso. After being falsely arrested by the apartheid regime for sabotage at an oil refinery where he works, his wife is jailed and tortured. He decides to fight back. He joins the African National Congress. We'll speak with Academy Award-winning actor Tim Robbins, who co-stars in the film, and the producer of the film, Robin Slovo. She's the daughter of anti-apartheid leaders Ruth First and Joe Slovo. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The head of the British military says foreign occupation is worsening the situation in Iraq and should come to an end. In an interview with the British newspaper The Daily Mail, General Sir Richard Dannett said, quote, "I don't say that the difficulties we're experiencing around the world are caused by our presence in Iraq, but undoubtedly our presence in Iraq exacerbates them." He adds, "We're in a Muslim country, and Muslims' views of foreigners in their country are quite clear. As a foreigner, you can be welcomed by being invited in a country, but we weren't invited certainly by those in Iraq at the time." Dannett's statement made front-page headlines around Britain. Many reports suggest his comments signify a major split between the military and Prime Minister Tony Blair. But Dannett later denied this was the case.
The comment needs to be just put in context. There are certain places where we are that we are attacked because we are there. Now, there are other places in Basra, an operation that's going on at the present moment, called Operation Salamanca, where we're deliberately going into districts to make things better for people. We're doing reconstruction tasks and development tasks, and they appreciate that. But in other places, because we are there, we constitute a target and we are attacked. And it's in that sense that our presence exacerbates the problem.
The British general's comments come amid reports the Congressional Commission established to assess the Iraq war has ruled out the prospect of a U.S. victory. According to the New York Sun, the two main strategies considered by the Iraq Study Group both contradict President Bush's rhetorical vow to establish democracy in Iraq. In another rebuke to the administration's policies, both strategies would encourage the U.S. to hold talks with Syria and Iran. The commission's findings will not be released until after the midterm elections next month. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the Iraqi parliament has passed a law that would allow the creation of separate autonomous regions. The vote passed over the objection of Sunnis, who say it will lead to the breakup of Iraq. In a concession to Sunni concerns, the law says the regions cannot be formed for at least 18 months. A former top British official has admitted he advised Prime Minister Tony Blair to bomb the Arabic television network Al Jazeera during the opening months of the Iraq war. In an interview with Britain's Channel 4, former Home Secretary David Blunkett says he told Blair to strike Al Jazeera's transmitting equipment because it was broadcasting, quote, propaganda. Blunkett explained, quote, "There wasn't a worry from me because I believed this was a war, and in a war, you wouldn't allow the broadcast to continue taking place." 2 weeks after Blunkett recommended the attack, the U.S. military bombed Al Jazeera's office in Baghdad, killing correspondent Tarek Ayoub. On Thursday, Al Jazeera editor-in-chief Ahmed Al-Sheikh said, quote, "This adds to the growing number of evidence that will one day prove that the attack on Al Jazeera was premeditated at the highest levels. Al Jazeera was being targeted at the time because the people who were waging war on Iraq didn't like what it was showing. We talk about terrorism. This is pure terrorism," he said. In other news, the U.S. military has released 17 new prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. The prisoners, 16 Afghans and one Iranian, all arrived in Afghanistan Thursday. At a news conference in Kabul, the newly freed Dr. Khan Jan described his ordeal.
"They were treating us like animals. They were not treating us as human beings. They were too cruel. Their behavior was not imaginable. They were punishing us very badly like animals."
Another prisoner, 20-year-old Habib Rahman, said he was tortured as recently as 4 months ago. He said, quote, "They were kicking us all the time, beating us with their hands. On one occasion, Rahman said he was interrogated for 38 hours without sleep. Also speaking Thursday was freed prisoner Mohammed Nasin.
Their behavior was against Islam, against our Quran. Three Arab prisoners died during prosecution and searches. The living conditions were very bad.
The freed prisoners' comments come as a U.S. Marine sergeant has come forward with new allegations of abuse at Guantanamo. In an interview with ABC News, Marine Corps Sergeant Heather Cervini said she was told of the abuse over drinks with several of the soldiers who carried it out. Sergeant Cervini said one sailor recounted taking a prisoner by the head and smashing him into a cell door. Another said he punched a prisoner in the face because the prisoner irritated him. The sergeant said the soldiers laughed when she asked them about the consequences of the abuse. The Pentagon says it's investigating. Meanwhile, Britain is continuing to push for the closure of the Guantanamo prison. On Thursday, Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett said the indefinite detention of Guantanamo prisoners is, quote, unacceptable and ineffective in terms of counterterrorism. At the United Nations, the Security Council appears close to agreeing on a response to North Korea's announced nuclear test. The Bush administration has reportedly dropped language threatening wide-ranging sanctions and the possibility of military force. A vote's expected Saturday. In the occupied territories, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says the number of Palestinian children killed this year is nearly double the number for all 2005. 13-year-old Suhaib Qadia became the 92nd Palestinian child this year when she was shot Thursday during an Israeli attack on Gaza. Overall, Israel's killed more than 800 Palestinian children since the beginning of the Second Intifada 6 years ago. In Russia, the newspaper of slain Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya has published an unfinished article she was writing at the time of her murder. She was killed on Saturday as she returned home to her apartment. She was one of Russia's leading journalists and human rights advocates. The unfinished article is a detailed account of brutal torture committed by the Russian-backed Chechen officials. Many believe Politkovskaya was killed because of her outspoken criticism of President Vladimir Putin, the Chechen war, and possibly the unfinished article itself. In Britain, a London resident has pleaded guilty to plotting terrorist attacks in Britain and the United States. 34-year-old Darren Barot said he planned to use a radioactive dirty bomb in Britain. He also admitted to planning attacks on the Washington headquarters of the IMF and World Bank, the New York Stock Exchange, and the Prudential buildings in Newark, New Jersey. Prosecutors say the plot never reached an advanced stage and that Barot had no funding or bomb-making equipment. In France, lawmakers have passed a bill that criminalizes denial of the Armenian Holocaust. The bill was passed over the fierce lobbying of the Turkish government. Turkey continues to deny it killed some 1.5 million Armenians during the First World War. Here in New York, a 29-year-old gay man is clinging to life following an apparent hate crime that started on the internet. The victim, Michael Sandy, was chatting online with two men who convinced him to meet them for sex at a Brooklyn parking lot. Police say Sandy, an African American, was met by four white males who robbed and beat him. The men chased Sandy onto a nearby street where he was hit by a passing car. The men beat him again as he lay on the road. Sandy has suffered extensive brain damage and is on life support. In Albany, New York, two Muslim immigrants have been convicted on terrorism charges in a case that raised major questions over the conduct of government officials. The men, Yassin Aref and Mohammed Hossein, were convicted of aiding a government informant in a fake plot to assassinate a Pakistani diplomat. The men's attorneys say their clients had no violent history and are the victims of government entrapment. Earlier this year, defense lawyers failed to have the case dismissed on the grounds it came out of the Bush administration's warrantless spy program. In Pennsylvania, the retail giant Walmart has lost a class action lawsuit that says it violated a series of state labor laws. On Thursday, a jury ruled Walmart illegally forced employees to work through rest breaks and during time not counted on the clock. Lawyers are seeking at least $62 million for close to 190,000 current and former employees. The jury is expected to decide on damages later today. Analysts say the case could have a major impact on several similar lawsuits against Walmart across the United States. And in an update on a story we've been following, Iraq war resister Sergeant Ricky Clausing has been sentenced to 3 months of confinement for going absent without leave. Sergeant Clausing went AWOL after returning from Iraq in April 2005. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our interview with him just hours before he turned himself in to Fort Lewis 2 months ago. And finally, the Nobel Peace Prize was announced earlier today.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2006, divided into two equal parts, to Muhammad Yunus and Grameen Bank for their efforts to create economic and social development from below. Lasting peace cannot be achieved unless large population groups find ways in which to break out of poverty. Microcredit is one such means.
Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank's pioneering of microcredit loans to the poor beat out a list of close to 200 candidates, including the U.S. peace activist Cindy Sheehan and the Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Torture, terrorism, indefinite detention. These are the phrases that have become common post 9/11. Well, today we look at a new film about South Africa under apartheid rule, a regime where torture and indefinite detention were commonplace for most of the population. And the label terrorist was applied to those seeking to end apartheid and bring democracy to the country. The film is called Catch a Fire, and it tells the story of black South African freedom fighter Patrick Chamuso.
Patrick was a foreman at the Secunda oil refinery, which was a symbol of South Africa's economic might at a time when the world was protesting the country's apartheid system. Patrick leaves his job and family to join up with the African National Congress and becomes a rebel fighter and political operative. He eventually plans a crucial strike against Secunda after his wife is tortured. Catch a Fire is written by Sean Slovo, who is the daughter of the legendary anti-apartheid leaders Joe Slovo and Ruth First. Joe Slovo was one of the founders of Umkhonto weSizwe, or MK, which was the armed wing of the African National Congress. He was general secretary of the South African Communist Party during the 1980s. This is Sean Slovo explaining why she wrote the film.
The idea for this film started in the early 80s. In 1980, after the attacks on the Sasol oil refinery, which were organized by the ANC in exile in Mozambique at that point, masterminded by Joe Slovo, who is my father. And after those attacks, which Joe was very proud of, in a sense, because it was just a complete outsider job and involved nobody on the ground in South Africa, he said to me that if you ever want to write a story set in this time about using the context of the struggle against a fight against apartheid by the exiled ANC, he said you must tell the story of Patrick Chamuso. I think the main reason I wanted to tell his story is because he's not one of the heroes or martyrs of the South African struggle per se. He's not a Nelson Mandela or a Steve Biko or a Thabo Mbeki or a Jacob Zuma. He wasn't, you know, he doesn't have that kind of background, and he isn't lauded in this country. His is the story of an ordinary black, working-class South African who decided to take control of his life. He's an everyman.
That's Catch a Fire's writer, Sean Slovo. This is Patrick Chamuso, the man who Catch a Fire is based on.
I'm a last man in the class of the people. I'm the man from the grassroots. And it's not always a story of a man like that being told to the world. Always the writers and the filmmakers, they go to the well-known people. But I can see from today that generals and presidents who makes history. I feel proud because I didn't expect that a film like this can be made on my behalf. Definitely, that was not my dream. I thought we did what we did in the struggle. I did my sentence on Robben Island and finished. Now we are free. I was just sitting at home thinking that, no, I'm going to sit at home and then waiting for my day to die. I didn't think that something historical like this will happen to me. It's not something that I planned, and it's not something that anybody has planned. It just happened. So for me, I'm very proud of
Patrick Tramuso himself. Catch a Fire is based on his character. The film's being released nationwide October 27th. Well, Tim Robbins and Robin Slovo join us in the studio now. Academy Award winner Tim Robbins plays Nick Vos, a colonel in South Africa's police security branch. Robin Slovo is the producer of Catch a Fire, yes, and the screenwriter, sister of the screenwriter, Sean Slovo. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Robin. Why you and your sister have produced and written this film?
I think primarily because it's a really good story. The story of Patrick Tramuso, Sean would say, is a very exciting story that really needs to be told. I think the fact that it's a story set in South Africa naturally comes from the fact that we are both South Africans with a big South African history. And I really think there's a simple answer to that question, which is it's a great story set in a South Africa, which I think is a story that's very rarely told.
Great in the sense that it represents the enormous transformation that's occurred in the country and the role of the ordinary people of South Africa in achieving their liberation? Or
I would say absolutely. I think that South Africa is a completely unique country in the world today, and that it's become a shining example of how, you know, because if I think back to the late 90s, if somebody had told me South Africa was going to change, I mean, it was an impenetrable, impossible, terrible country for a very long time with huge, almost insurmountable problems. And I think the prophecies at that time, and up till, you know, relatively recently, was that if the government was to change in South Africa, there would be rivers of blood. And I think what South Africa shows is there's another way to achieve basically democracy. It came from a police state virtually, to a really shining example of how democracy can work.
And why do you think that was, in terms of the, because you're right, many people around the world were saying it's only going to be a bloodbath there to eliminate white minority rule. Why was it able to make that transformation?
Well, I think that the best way to explain that is to quote from Patrick Tramuso, who is the subject of this film. And when asked that question, he says that they did not want to be what their enemies thought they might be, and therefore they didn't want to be vengeful. They thought a very long time about how to respond. And in the South African Freedom Charter, it says South Africa belongs to all of us, black and white. I think allied to the fact that the ANC is a very sophisticated political organization. And the leadership said, you know, had spent a long time thinking about a transition. And I think thought about it very carefully.
Tim Robbins, tell us the story of Nick Vos and Patrick Tramuso.
Well, Patrick was a foreman at a power plant, oil refinery, and he was a non-political person. He was a person that was interested simply in raising his family and towing the line and moving up the ladder and getting more and more money. And there's a bombing in the plant that he has nothing to do with, and he's arrested and tortured, accused of the crime, held in detention without any kind of legal representation. And then and I play the character that arrests him and interrogates him. Through the course of several days, they get nothing from him, at which point they pull in his wife, they arrest his wife, and involve her in torture as well. At which point Patrick snaps, confesses to the crime, which he didn't commit. The character I play, although he is a person that engages in torture, does realize that the confession is false and releases him. At which point Patrick, because not only has he been humiliated, his family has been compromised as well. He leaves South Africa to go to train in another country with the ANC, with MK, to really become what this policeman feared he was. In essence, a good warning for today, you know, what happens when you throw out due process and what happens when you involve in torture. Oftentimes you exacerbate the problem, create more problem, more enemies than you had in the first place.
He joins in controversies, right?
He joins MK. And so
this is the armed wing of the ANC.
That's right. And at which point he returns to South Africa and actually does participate in an act of aggression against his former employer.
We're going to break and we'll come back. Tim Robbins is our guest, Academy Award-winning actor, writer, and producer. Robin Slovo, also our guest. She is the producer of Catch a Fire and daughter of two anti-apartheid leaders, Ruth First and Joe Slovo. Stay with us.
Is the unknown grave the one who died maintaining his night? His will been so strong and musically inclined. His sad melodies coming out like a smoke from the woody fire. And he sang, my boo, Africa, sing now, Africa, sing loud, sing to the people. Let them give something to the world and not just take from it. And will ring the bells when you come back? Will you beat the drums when you come back home? Will you ring the bells when you come back? Will you beat the drums when you come back home? Will you ring the bells when you come back?
Vusi Malasela here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also in Spanish in audio and transcript form, and any radio station can pick up the Spanish headlines as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about this new film called Catch a Fire that's opening across the country. It's about apartheid South Africa and a man named Patrick Chamuso, based on a true story. This is a scene in the film where Patrick is falsely arrested for the first time.
What's your name? Patrick Chamuso.
Para denunciar, ¿eh?
Es mi cámara, boss.
Whose car is this? Whose car is this?
My car, boss.
Patrick. Where are you going, Patrick?
I'm going home, boss.
Where do you get the money for this nice car and that nice camera?
No, boss, I work. I have a job. I'm a foreman, boss. I work at Secunda.
Small is searching.
Yay. Hey, how still, man? Let's help me, huh? Hey, yay. Come back here, sir.
Down! Down!
In this scene, Patrick joins up with the ANC resistance. Here he is questioned by Joe Slovo and an ANC fighter.
Have you told anyone that you were coming to Mozambique?
No, not even my family.
Once you cross that fence, once you decide to fight back, everything is different. You cannot contact anyone on the other side. That means no phone calls, no letters. You may never see your family again.
Do you still want to go on?
They have killed my friend, tortured my wife for nothing. Yes, I want to go on.
Patrick Chamuso, his character, being questioned when he went to Mozambique to join up with the armed wing of the ANC. Our guests are Tim Robbins, who acts in the film, is one of the stars of the film, as well as Robin Slovo, who produced the film. Now, in this scene, we see him being questioned by two men. One of them is your father, is Joe Slovo. Can you talk about your father and his relationship with MK, with the armed wing of the ANC?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Joe was very unique as well, in the sense that he was one of the very few white men who became fully part of the ANC and of MK. He was the first white member of the national executive of the ANC when it was legalized, and he was a minister in Mandela's first government. He was the housing minister. And I think his story is he was a politicized young man. He went to work when he was 12 years old in a factory, and he joined a union. And because he was in South Africa, he obviously became aware of the most crucial issue, which is that he was living in the apartheid state. And from that point on, he trained as a lawyer. He worked with as a lawyer with Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu, and the rest is history, basically. He helped set up the military wing. And when the Rivonia trial happened, when Mandela and Sisulu were put on Robben Island, Joe was out of the country, and he was wanted from that point on. He was supposed to be one of that group. And he felt very, very passionately and strongly. He never forgot the fact that he should have been doing life in prison with the rest of them. So he dedicated the rest of his life, his entire life, to fighting to free his comrades from Robben Island and also to help change South Africa. And of course his dream came true, because he returned in 92 and became part of the first government. So it's a wonderful story.
And amazingly, not only your father but your mother were both university classmates with Nelson Mandela, and also the founder of the Mozambique Freedom Movement of Frelimo in the 1940s. It's an astonishing collection of people who have built friendships from their university days as radical students.
Yeah.
In terms of your life with your parents and the kinds of things that you were exposed to as children in this continuing battle, would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we're talking about the 50s and the 60s, when repression really started to become intense in South Africa. And my memory, along with Sean, the screenwriter, and our other sister, Gillian, is that we were constantly being harassed. You know, even as children, our parents were continuously being arrested, put in prison. There were all sorts of trials, and that we were brought up totally with the knowledge, because we were children, of not exactly knowing what was going on, but knowing that there were all sorts of illicit things. For example, you couldn't meet with black people. You literally couldn't have a black person in your house. And so we would be aware when there was a meeting taking place with our parents and there was a black South African there, that this was to be kept secret. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to say is, obviously, one of the things that had the greatest impact upon our family was that in 1982, our mother, Ruth First, was working in Mozambique. She was an academic predominantly. She was different from Joe. She was as active as Joe, but she did it through the world of academia, through the UN. She wrote books, she wrote pamphlets, she was a speaker, a very important anti-apartheid activist. She was murdered by a parcel bomb, which was sent to her in Mozambique by the special branch.
Robin, your sister, Sean, also wrote a film that was based on the life of your mother, the film called A World Apart. And this is a scene where the fictionalized Sean, your sister, confronts her mother about a suicide attempt while she was in prison.
I was afraid. I was afraid I would have put other people in danger.
What people?
Our friends, people like Harold.
Your friends, your work, that's all you care
about.
Right,
my friends, my work, yes. But what we care about is the whole country.
What about me?
You live here, you eat here, I'm down the passage. But what about Elsie's children?
I'm not Elsie's child, I'm your child.
Yeah, listen to me. Elsie can't live with her children. Why? Because she's black. At Sharpeville, people were shot down, shot in the back, shot running away. Solomon, he's been murdered.
I know that. Stop treating me like a child.
All right, you're right. You do know. I know you know. But I also know how much you'd understand if you only let yourself.
You never tell me anything. I don't know what's going on.
We can't even talk amongst ourselves. It's not safe.
I don't even know where Daddy is. Where he left, it's not fair, you're never with me. And all
from the film A World Apart, Robin, your response to growing up with your mother and what that scene was at what point in her life.
Well, That was in 1963, when Joe was out of the country and Ruth was actually arrested under the 90-day detention law, which, you know, they suspended. There was no habeas corpus in South Africa, so they just arrested her, did not charge her, kept her in for 90 days, and then on the 90th day, released her and rearrested her and kept her in. And I think she, at that point, just lost hope. She's written a book about it. And this scene that's taking place that Sean wrote about, essentially the film is both a sort of praise poem to Ruth and what a fantastic woman she was, and also it's an examination of how difficult it is to be the children of people who spend their whole lives fighting to save other children. And it's, you know, I mean, I wouldn't regret it for a second. I feel so privileged, as does Sean, to have had parents who set such a wonderful example. But there's no question it's a tough life for children. You know, our parents were not around as much as they should have been. And that scene, I think, is about that dilemma.
And Tim, there are lots of great stories in the world. Why did you decide you wanted to be in this film and be a part of this at this particular time?
Well, the script was so compelling. The idea was about not a star of the movement, but a worker within the movement. It also, on a pure entertainment level, had a real kind of compelling pulse to it. It's got an action element. It really works as an entertainment. Directed by Philip Noyce, who really does know how to do those kinds of movies. He's done some pretty exciting thrillers in the past. And what I truly love about the movie is here you have this movie that's churning along like this locomotive, like an action movie, and it gets to that final reel, and that obligatory scene that the audience is expecting, that one where the good guy gets the bad guy and there's some retributive act of violence and the audience erupts, is not there. The filmmaker asks you, the audience, respects the audience, I think, enough to know that they don't need that, that there's something even more exciting and more compelling and more inspiring in the final reel of this story. And that is the story of Patrick Chamuso, the true story. The true story of South Africa, the true story of Mandela. The idea that you can come out of years and years of oppression and years of internment with a sense of forgiveness, with a sense of the future, with a vision for the future that allows for it's the movement, the leaders, to say, no, we're moving forward. We're not going to look backwards. We're not going to be one of these countries that is going to waste years and years of time with retribution, with trials, with tribunals, with people being dragged out of their houses in the middle of the night, being beaten in the streets. That's not going to happen here. And when you go to South Africa, you realize this, it is a miracle. It is this truly remarkable achievement that's happened there. And if you think about history, it's really never been done, where you've come to the end of a struggle or the end of a war, and the leaders have said, let's forgive.
I wanted to turn to another scene, this one you're in, Tim Robbins' character, police security branch officer Nick Vos, trying to get information about Patrick's whereabouts from his wife. Her name is Precious.
Going back to work? Have you left? You lost your house now. Living in a one-room shack. No money coming in. Maybe I can help you, Precious. Use my influence. Find you somewhere better to live. When you hear from Patrick, you let me know. You must ask yourself, where is he? Who's he with now? Where does he sleep at night?
Nick Vos, he's the apartheid colonel, trying to question Precious as he drives along the car and she won't answer as she's walking on the road. What kind of research did you do for this?
Both Derek Luke and I, Derek plays Patrick Chamuso, when we got to Africa, we realized not only did we have to get these characters and these difficult accents, but we really had to discover a continent, you know, and truly discover what South Africa was all about. Each country being a completely different entity in Africa. The idea of approaching the subject matter was pretty daunting, but Philip Noyce had so many people from South Africa on the film, hired a pretty exclusively South African crew. So we all had advisors. He had Patrick, he had other people from the ANC, I had special branch officers, all of whom wanted to tell their story, all of whom felt that it was necessary to tell this story, which is another element of the whole idea of moving forward and forgiveness, and the idea that I was playing someone who had done illegal things, and I had advisors who had done those things there as part of kind of a sense of, I don't know, spiritual rebirth, or that started with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and has continuing through this day with people like my advisor, Henty Botha, who was clearly trying to absolve some kind of guilt or trying to move past what his past had forced upon him. A lot of these guys, you know, as difficult as it was for me to get my head around, the idea of what it means to cross that line, and who is asking whom to cross that line, and there's a lot of bitterness with these guys now, being made the bad guys in retrospect, when in fact they were doing the bidding of a South African government. It was their duty to do this policing. They were encouraged to break the law. It was kept in secret. They couldn't come forward. They couldn't share it with their wives. And in retrospect, they were the ones that were blamed, when in fact the leaders of the country were the ones that had forced this kind of policy upon them.
Won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Exactly. Right, exactly. And as they
Mandela.
Put it, as they put it, living in mansions with very healthy pensions, while we, you know, have lost our families. A lot of these guys' wives divorced them when they found out the truth, and they historically are bearing the brunt of the blame. And it begs the larger question, you know, when you are serving your country, when you are out of duty, out of patriotism, trying to enforce the policies of the administration you're working for, where does the moral bottom line, where is it drawn? How much can you walk away from that? A lot of these guys felt enslaved to it. They felt that if they walked away, they would be betraying country, they would be bringing shame upon their family. I asked why didn't you, they said we couldn't. It was like we were in the middle of a war and would be to leave the battlefield. So some did, but it was a very, very difficult decision to make.
It's trying to capture the humanity of the people on the front lines on the oppressing side is really a difficult task. I'm reminded of the film, that classic Marlon Brando character in Burn in the 1970s film, trying to portray an English intelligence officer, or the Indochine film where the French inspector trying to chase Vietnamese guerrillas in the 1950s, a similar type of thing. What happens in a resistance movement to the people on the front lines who are fighting that resistance?
Well, and they're all victims of the struggle. It's not to justify or rationalize it at all, but you can't torture a person and walk out of the room with a clean soul. It's just not going to happen. In your duty, in your performance of that duty, you are oftentimes compromising yourself and your own humanity, and your own morality, to an irrecoverable place, a place where you for the rest of your life have been compromised by your participation in something like torture.
Which brings us inevitably to a conversation about today. And after the break, we're going to go to an interview with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Well, today is the announcement of the new Nobel Peace Prize. It's going to Muhammad Yunus. Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa won the Nobel Peace Prize. And this week he turns 75. And Robin, your other sister, you're the youngest of three, Sean being the oldest, and Jillian Slovo, the middle sister, and then you, the youngest, Robin. Jillian wrote a fascinating play together with Victoria Britton, putting together the testimony of men at Guantanamo, called Guantanamo. And when it opened in New York, Archbishop Desmond Tutu came and did some of the reading. I'd like you both, in ending this conversation, to talk about the relevance today.
Well, the idea that when you throw out due process, it's a slippery slope. You not only compromise the agents of the state that are working for you, but you're compromising the whole process of democracy. I think it's all done with the intent that it's going to somehow help, but ultimately it's something that makes more enemies than it gets rid of. And I think we're seeing that, you know. I think that, you know, that's a very relevant and salient point that the film touches upon. The film also touches upon the idea of forgiveness and what that means and how that's achievable and how that may be the only way forward in this struggle.
But that came after acknowledgement. Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the key point there was that the only way someone could get amnesty is if they described exactly what they did.
Right.
The crimes they committed.
Right, right. True. And that is part of the process, yes. But even so, there were some people that did not come forward, that did not admit responsibility. And in knowing that, people like Patrick Chamuso still had to move forward. They still had to be a larger person, a more courageous person, in forgiving and forgetting.
And what is Patrick Chamuso doing these days?
He's been with us touring around the country talking, and we hope to get him on this show at some point.
We hope to talk to him. What
Patrick Chamuso is doing is he's running an orphanage in the area where he lives. He's looking after 88 children who've been orphaned, mostly by AIDS and HIV, which, as we know, is a huge problem in South Africa. And he's a man who, with his pension, MK, soldier's pension, just looked around him and saw there were children who needed looking after, and gradually has got to the position where he's now got 88 children in his house, feeds them, educates them, gets them donations for toys. Basically, he's contributing to contemporary
South
Africa.
If you want to help that organization, it's twosisters.org.za.
For South Africa.
Yep.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. The film is called Catch a Fire, and it's coming out all over the country in the next 2 weeks. Tim Robbins, Academy Award-winning actor, writer, and producer. Robin Slovo is the producer of this film, Catch a Fire, and the daughter of anti-apartheid leaders Ruth First and Joe Slovo. When we come back from break, we'll hear from Archbishop Desmond Tutu when he came to this country. Stay with us.
Every time I hear it.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, The Music Slave Driver by Bob Marley and the Wailers from the album Catch a Fire. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We end today's show with the words of South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu. In 1984, Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize. At the time, he was at the forefront of the anti-apartheid campaign. Earlier this week, he turned 75. Over 1,000 people, including Nelson Mandela, gathered in Johannesburg to pay tribute to the man.
And because today is the day of the announcement of the new Nobel Peace Prize winner, Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank, we thought we'd bring you Desmond Tutu's words. A new biography on him has just been published. It's entitled Rabble Rouser for Peace. Well, I had the opportunity to interview Archbishop Desmond Tutu 2 years ago. He was visiting New York for a reading of the play Guantanamo at the Culture Project. Again, it was written by Robin Slovo's sister, Jillian Slovo, and Victoria Britton. I asked him for his response to what is happening at Guantanamo.
For someone coming from South Africa, you said, but I mean, that's exactly what they were doing for exactly the same reasons that they gave. I mean, you said, why do you detain people without trial? Why do you ban people as you're doing? And the response from the South African government was security of the state. And anyone who questioned it would then be regarded, especially if you were white, as being unpatriotic. And I just want to say to you, is this something that you want done in your name? Isn't it time there was the same sense of outrage that people had about apartheid, which people should have had about the Holocaust? And what would happen if it was Americans held by some other country under these conditions? The point is, God has actually got no one. The God we worship is strange. They say this God is omnipotent, but God is also very weak. There's not a great deal that God seems to be able to do without you.
During your years in South Africa, before the end of apartheid, you were a deep advocate of nonviolence, yet you saw so many detained, so many killed. What do you feel, and what did you feel then? How did you make it through those days? What did you advocate? How did you stick to your principles of nonviolence?
One of the wonderful things, actually, is when I've got to speak as a Christian, is belonging to the church and knowing that you belong to this extraordinary body. When things were really rough, it's wonderful to recall for me now that I sometimes got, when the South African government had taken away my passport, I got passports of love from Sunday school kids here in New York, and I plastered them on the walls of my office, that although I couldn't travel, hey, here were all of these wonderful people all over the world. And I had a, I met a nun in New York at that particular time, and I asked her, can you just tell me a little bit about your life? How do you? And she said, well, I am a solitary. I live in the woods in California. I pray for you. My day starts at 2 a.m. And I said, hey, man, I'm being prayed for at 2 a.m. in the woods in California. What chance does the apartheid government stand? So one was being upheld. And you know, when frequently you say to people, the victory that we won against apartheid, a spectacular victory, that would not have happened without the support of the international community, without the support of people like yourselves, without the support of those who were students at the time, who might have been crazies, but they were fantastic in their commitment. And in this country, actually, they showed that you could in fact change the moral climate. Because at the time, the Reagan administration was totally opposed to sanctions. And students, but not just students, the many, many people who were prepared to be arrested on our behalf, who demonstrated on our behalf, who boycotted on our behalf, well, they changed the moral climate to such an extent that Congress passed the anti-apartheid legislation, and they even managed a veto override, which was fantastic. And so I just happened. I always say I was a leader by default, because our real leaders were either in jail or in exile. And sometimes when people say, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize, I say, well, actually, you know, it was that they thought maybe it was time it was given to a black. And, he has an easy surname. Imagine if I'd had a surname like Buqaqauli, you know.
Archbishop Tutu, how do you feel? How do you feel about...
You can pronounce that.
How do you feel about the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
It was fantastic seeing the many, many people who came out in opposition. It was fantastic. You know, sometimes when you say, Americans, or, people nowadays don't care. It's not true. Millions turned out. Millions said, no, give peace a chance. And I said, as so many others, I wasn't the only one. The Pope said so too. The Archbishop of Canterbury said so. The Dalai Lama said so. That this war, if it was to be a justifiable war in terms of the just war theory, would have to be one that was declared by a legitimate authority. And And the administration here was aware of that. That's why they went to the UN. There's no point in going to the UN if you had already decided. They probably, of course, had decided. But I mean, there was no point unless they believed or they realized, I mean, that in order for it to be legitimate and therefore justifiable, the only authority would have to be the UN. And when they didn't get what they wanted from the UN, they did what they did. We said then, and we keep saying so, not just that it was illegal, it was immoral. And the consequences of it just now, I mean, you have to be, you've really got to be blind to say, well, yeah, it's okay, we removed Saddam Hussein. Why didn't you say that was the reason for going? Because the world would have said, no, that isn't a reason that will be allowable for you to declare the war. And I'm sad that we seem so inured now. They tell you 100 people have been killed. And the United States and its allies are doing that. And they say, No, we targeted that house because our intelligence said so. Intelligence. The same intelligence that said they were weapons of mass destruction. Please. That's been done in your name. That mothers and children have been killed. And when you say, what about the civilian casualties? Say, sorry, our intention was to target insurgents. And most of us, I think, just shrug our shoulders. But you see, you experienced a little bit on September the 11th, the kind of thing that is meted out on a regular basis.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's from South Africa, turned 75 this week. And that does it for our broadcast. He was speaking at the Culture Project in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshroof, Abdul Kadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Barichin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, engineers Uri Galed and Angela Alston. Our special thanks today. This weekend, tonight, I'll be in Tucson at 6 p.m., tomorrow in Pittsburgh at 3 at John Carroll University, in Cleveland at 7 p.m. At John Carroll, Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon, and on Sunday, Washington, D.C. at the D.C. Convention Center. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.